Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello again, welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and I am here alongside two very special gentlemen.
You know that's right.
We have with us today Mr. Chad Riley.
Howdy, Captain.
How's it going?
Pretty well. I mean, you know, we just sat through a really long movie, so we got to talk about it.
And of course, newcomer to the table, all around okay guy, Mr. Spencer Williams. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm still on this planet after this movie.
You're still on this planet? Was there any option to not be here? Is that what I'm understanding?
If there was, I would have taken it. But alas, here I am.
Spencer's rage rocket almost blasted him up to the moon.
If you don't know what we're talking about, we are talking about the recent film that we just saw in Fresh from the Theater, The Maze Runner, or Maze Runner, whatever, The Death Cure. We just recently went to go see that in theaters, and we came straight home to record, and yeah, we got some things to say.
We do have some things to say, because...
Quite a few things to say.
But not as many things as this movie, because we're not going to have a 2.5 hour long podcast episode about it.
Yeah. So, stick around as we jump into that review, but before we do, we're going to hit you with a little bit of opening credits.
All right, whether you're on the run or just having some fun, The Filmlosophers are presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. This isn't our first dash through the maze of pop culture. In fact, we've been up and running for nearly 2 years. Little trivia there. But no, we will accept gift cards, also gifts and kind letters from you in a couple weeks when we celebrate our second birthday. Subscribe to the podcast on Player FM, Audio Boom, Libsyn, Google Play, iTunes, or Stitcher, and catch new episodes as soon as they debut each Wednesday morning. Spencer, if they want to hit us up and find us in other places, where can they go?
You and your personal posse of film aficionados are welcome to interact with us on social media. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmphilosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmphilosophy101 to keep the conversation. You can also access our entire episode archive online at filmphilosophers.com.
We got a website!
Website!
Woo! Yeah, I still get a little excited because of the fact that we have, I don't know if it's excited or just sheer awareness that we have a URL we have yet to use. Yeah, because it's like, oh my gosh, we do. We have.
We had it. We've had it for the entire 2 years, and we've just now started saying it.
That's one of the first things we set up, and we were like, oh yeah, VGBstudios.com.
Which you can still find us on VGBstudios.com, but you don't have to remember that. You can just remember filmphilosophers.com.
That's right.
Short and to the point.
Short and sweet. Yeah.
Well, this conversation is really going 1,000 miles an hour right now.
Just like the Maze Runner movie we just saw.
So we are coming like
this. Cannot wait. For Spencer to get into this.
I don't even know how this is going to go.
Same.
So, like I said, we're fresh from the theater. We just went to go see The Maze Runner, The Death Cure, the third film in a trilogy, if you will. We weren't really sure what we were going to be getting into. We knew that it was another film of a young adult YA book series, and those have been hit or miss for the past few years. So we thought we would give it a fair shake, and we're regretting it. But before we get into that, Chad, why don't you hit us with a little bit of that synopsis stuff?
Sure. Thomas leads some escaped gladers on their final and most dangerous mission yet. Although you wouldn't know it because there's a lot of exposition going on. To save their friends, they must break into the legendary Last City, a wicked-controlled labyrinth that may turn out to be the deadliest maze of all. Anyone who makes it out alive will get answers to the questions that the gladers have been asking since they arrived in the maze.
I didn't get any of that.
Wait, when I saw this movie. I have a serious question.
Yeah.
Was that a synopsis you wrote, or we got that online?
I think Eddie took it from IMDb or somewhere like that.
Oh, no. I don't agree with that at all.
So basically what's happened to this point is lots and lots of like specialized terminology, which we had conversations before watching this movie years ago when the first Maze Runner book came out. I thumbed through the first few pages and I put the book back on the shelf in the bookstore. I was like, nope, I'm not reading this. It's got way... It's just bombarding you with special terminology, like gladers and greeny and what, like all these things that it was just a little overwhelming for me. I'm like, ah, that's too much special vocabulary. And I think that that's something that they obviously translated into the films because they're trying to be somewhat faithful. They're not really faithful to the storyline from what I understand of the novels, but they at least use the vocab words. It's interesting because any synopsis you read of the books or of the movies, it's like, okay, I have no idea what's going on. Basically, yeah. Some people are running around. They're part of a government test. There's like this plague disease thing that turns some people into zombies and then others are immune. And all of these tests are supposedly trying to condition certain possibly immune young people to... I don't know, like improve upon their own genetics through adrenaline and fear-based like running around. Yeah. And then they're going to create some potent serum that could potentially cure everyone who's infected by this zombie plague thing. And so this being the last story, they're going to the seat of power. So Wicked, WCKD, it stands for something. Very obscure. They are basically the government research group, right? That's and paramilitary group that is doing these tests, setting up these mazes and challenges for the kids to run through. And many of them end up dying, unfortunately, in these different scenarios. But this government group has one city that they basically walled off so that the people who are infected with the zombie plague can't get in. And so this is sort of the last step, the last stand, if you will, of our heroes trying to, I don't know, fight the power. It's hard to say exactly what's going on because there's a lot going on, but then there's also not a whole lot going on.
Wicked, by the way, according to the book, which Wicked is WICKED, is World in Catastrophe, Kill Zone Experiment Department.
Why would you put a colon in the middle of an acronym?
Hey, I'm just reporting the news.
Oh, it's weird, though.
I'm shaking my head in disdain right now, and my eyes are closed. I can't even look at the screen right now.
Directed by Wes Ball, the film stars Dylan O'Brien, Kaya Scolodario, Thomas Brody Sangster, Will Poulter, Giancarlo Esposito, Rosa Salazar, Barry Pepper, Patricia Clarkson, and many others. As we said, this is the third chapter in the Maze Runner trilogy. The books were written by James Dashner and debuted during a wave of popularity in young adult books, such as the Hunger Games series, the Divergent series, and, of course, the Red Rising series, which
far
we are
superior.
A big fan of. Due to Dylan O'Brien's injury during filming, which he sustained in March of 2016, and of his eventual recovery, the release date of the film, originally slated for February 17th, 2017, was postponed to January 12th, 2018. Filming for this film was immediately halted after O'Brien was hospitalized. So, thankfully, he recovered and they finished the film. And
well, it was a fairly serious accident. It was a stunt scene involving a vehicle, and the way I understand it from reading it, the vehicle, like his body and the vehicle, collided in a way that they weren't supposed to.
Wow.
So, you know, the fact that he was okay and able to recover and then they finished filming is actually very good for him and, you know, for the franchise, I guess.
Well, whatever puts the nail in the coffin. So, was I the only person who...
Dang, ruthless.
Every time I heard the word Wicked, I was thinking, like, this has got to be, like, the author had to be, like, Bostonian or something. Like, look at that Wicked... Everything was Wicked. Look at those Wicked kids, eh, Mark? They're great.
No, see, here's...
What?
I don't know what just happened. That also sounded nothing like a Bostonian
accent. I don't know.
The force is not with you right now.
It's okay.
We just lost Boston on this podcast.
Yeah, sorry, guys. It was Eddie's fault. Spencer and I would never do that to you. But I think that actually, though, is indicative of, again, my big problem with the book was as soon as I opened it, it's throwing all of these special words that don't actually need to be there. Like all the special terms that the kids have made up for themselves and their environment and all of it. And then all these acronyms for the big bad guys, you know, like it's kind of, it's just overdone. It's, you don't need that many. Pick four, not 28.
Yeah.
Because it really does muddle the communication. Like if you're just a mainstream audience goer, you haven't read the books, you're going to give it a chance. It's still off-putting to have so many of these special terms thrown around all over the place that are like, what are they describing? What, like the second movie, right? The Scorch. Mm-hmm. Just say the desert. Like it's a desert. Just say it's a desert, but it's the Scorch. Like everything has to have a special name. Yeah. Like everything, every person, every group, every place. And it's just, it's a little overdone. It's honestly not a problem, I think, with the movies. It's a problem they've inherited from the books.
And I think one of the things to take away from that is you, of course, have certain films that were either adapted by, you know, from a book or from some type of literary source. And you have, obviously, certain instances where made-up words are a part of the script. Mm-hmm. Say, for instance, and we were talking about this over lunch today, say, for instance, like Lord of the Rings. There's a lot of things that were made up in that book. But the thing is that that book is based in fantasy. There is a sense of realism in this series that should hold to the English language in terms of like, okay, they're humans. They're humans who are facing ailments. And this is more of like a dystopic future, if you will.
Absolutely. It's meant to feel like our real world at some future point after things have started to fall apart dramatically.
So you would assume that at some point in time, you wouldn't really see that much of a de-evolution, if you will, of the English language in my mind. So why add that to a story and make it even more so unbelievable? Like for me, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, and when you've got a story, when you have a landscape that you've got different types of environments that the characters are interacting with, you've got monsters, you've got zombie people, you've got government groups, you've got scientists, the youth themselves have sort of like different cliques and posses within their groups. So all of that, it's a lot. It's sort of like just, again, pick four special terms and then the rest of them call it a monster, call it the jungle, call it the desert, call it the city, call it like just use normal terms so it's not so obscure that the average everyday moviegoer who has not read the books can still understand what they're watching. That's my soapbox moment. I'm going to cede the floor to Spencer because I know he's got a lot to say about this film.
And the funny thing is, before Spencer continues, is that we were leaving the theater and Spencer was literally about to blow his top. And we immediately said, nope, save it for the show because I'd rather that be recorded than it be
true.
All gone.
Why should the two of us be the only ones who get to hear this moment?
So I step back. The floor is yours, Spencer.
Okay, first off, I want to step back myself and say I have never seen any of these movies before. So to be, you know, fair and like knowledgeable, I watched the first two movies like the day before. That was my first mistake. Because like upon watching the first movie, like in the first 5 minutes, I was very irritated because people were talking about things. I had no idea what they were talking about. Like the kid Galley. That's one of the kids' names, Galley, apparently.
Yeah, they all have special names.
From the Glade. And why they're called Gladers when they haven't been in the Glade for like a movie now is confusing. But let's just ignore that. There's too many things to pick apart.
It's so true.
So they're like, he just gets there, the main kid, Thomas. And Galley's like, ah, this kid looks like a shank. And I'm like, what? Like, he's a pointy knife? That's like a word.
A prison tool? Is that what he's talking about?
Like, he said that, and I'm like, I know what a shank in, like, reality means, but I don't know what this means here. You wouldn't call a person a shank unless you're going to pick them up and stab another person with them. And even that makes no sense. So, the first movie was so irritating to me. And if you loved it, I'm sorry, I hated it.
So, it's okay. Real talk. Real talk from Spencer.
There you go.
And like the second movie that followed it, it was marginally better than the first movie. And I was like, okay, that's a good step in the right direction. It still had many problems. But I was like, if they keep this up, the third movie should be even better. That is highly debatable. I would like to say maybe the second movie is the best of the three.
Well, and in terms of, so when you adapt a movie from a literary piece, whether if it's a poem or a, you know, short story or a novel, however it is, you tend to want to stick close to, or at least, you know, be reminiscent of the source material. And we, myself and Spencer, were talking about it this morning about the second film.
Yes.
And I just happened to read the second book when I got a chance in preparation for today. And we were like, wait, when did that happen? Wait, didn't that happen?
I was instantly confused when you started talking. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Wait, what's happening in this book?
Like, Teresa's doing what? Wait, who's that? It was
so confusing because, like, in the book, Teresa's apparently a main antagonist of the second book. But in the film, she's not.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because by the time you get to the third film, she's definitely one of the antagonists.
Yes.
Right?
Which right? Is like,
I was like...
Like, she's firmly on the side of the bad guys the first time you see her and for the bulk of the movie.
Yeah, like, in the second, like, the final 5 minutes, she switches sides and then she becomes an antagonist in the second film. I'm like... Plus, she gives a speech for, like, the greater good, which was done much better in Star Trek 2, by the way. But, like, I'm trying not to meander into other films. It was so frustrating.
And then, so even before that, like, before we even saw the third film, I just happened to read, like, the Cliff Notes version of the third film, and I'm like...
Oh. The third book.
The third book.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, no. No, and I'm so I know what I said earlier, but I am extremely glad that they didn't go according to the book in the third film. So I was telling Chad that in the third book, they were actually supposed to be put back into a maze.
What? Oh no.
And then in the interim of events, the stuff was supposed to happen, and that's how a certain someone meets their demise. But it's like super weird.
I mean, if you think about it, though, I mean, that's kind of the motif of the Hunger Games as well, right? The first book, it's the whatever, the 74th annual Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. And then the second book, it's the third Quarter Quell, where they bring other champions back and they put them back in an arena. And then the third book, the takeover of the city is the arena, if you will. Like, the city has been turned into an arena.
Yeah.
The capital. So there are ways to do that kind of motif much, much better. Suzanne Collins, the writer of the Hunger Games series, she's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So she pulled it off, and then some, in my opinion. You know, so it gives you good source material to pull from. This, I think it's more of a, well, the series is called The Maze Runner, so just keep putting them in things called mazes. And it's like, but literally, The Hunger Games came out 3 years before The Maze Runner. So it's like, this whole series, always to me, looking from the outside, because again, I read 3 pages, got annoyed with it, put it back, never picked it up again. It all felt very derivative to me. Like, oh, somebody just said, oh, The Hunger Games was really popular. Let's make another kind of that and add zombies.
Divergent.
Let's not talk about Divergent. That's a sore subject.
Yeah, and it's when it comes to this particular film. So going back to what you're saying about Hunger Games, the incredible thing about Suzanne Collins and what she did with The Hunger Games is that you could see this working as a major motion film, even before the books got translated into movies, or even before the news came out that they were going to be made into movies. You could visualize and you're like, oh man, that would be so cool to see. That'd be great. In no way, shape, or form did I ever desire to see them be put back into a maze. It's like the worst Twilight Zone episode in the history. Like, I was like, I swear if they all of a sudden just end up waking up and they're like, oh, it was a bad dream. We're still in the maze. We never left in the first place. I'm like, I would have walked out. And mind you, that would have already been the end. So I would have left early.
I'm like, you would have wasted 2 hours and 17 minutes instead of 2 hours and 20.
I don't know, man. Like, I think the fact is that Suzanne Collins, as well as other phenomenal young adult writers.
She's not the only great young adult writer. But
like Suzanne Collins, Pierce Brown, people like that have set the bar really high.
Yes.
For what it is to expect when you see a young adult book. And mind you, it's not that the book's only geared for young adults. It's just the genre that they have. There's no other genre other than YA. But you have all these phenomenal sequels to their books and whatnot, and not to mention Pierce Brown has another book that he just debuted, Iron Gold,
which is the Red Rising series. For those of you who haven't read it yet, you should, because they are developing it into a movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's pre-production right now, but it's going to make a great... I would vote for that to be a TV series. Once you get into the second and third book especially, I mean, that is like multiple movies where it just keeps moving. There's just stuff. But that's the difference, too. In that series, there are meaningful plot twists and changes to the character situations that all build sequentially the way that a well-written story should. What I've seen in the movies, at least, again, not having read the Maze Runner books, in the movies, it's really more just a series of occurrences to keep the movie going. Not because they all really matter or make sense logically, but it's just a way of... Oh, we should put a twist here. We should put a conflict there. We should have a chase scene in here. But not because it makes organic sense to the story, just because they want to keep the pace moving forward a certain way. And you feel it. I think you feel it, especially in this film, which again clocks in at over 2 hours. I mean, thankfully they didn't split it into two movies, which they did with The Hunger Games, and they talked about with the Divergent series until they said, hey, this series isn't making any money. Let's do a TV movie to end it instead. And all the actors said, heck no. but so at least they crammed everything into one finale movie here, which is why it's so long. But as you're going through it, I'm just sitting there in the theater, I'm thinking, is this scene necessary?
Yeah.
Does this conversation need to be 4 minutes long, or could we have accomplished the same thing in a minute?
True.
And usually, like, you could have accomplished it in a minute. It's just not the way it was written. So you do a lot of, like, there are spurts of action, but then there's, like, a lot of waiting in between. And you're not entirely sure, like, okay, well, are we going anywhere, really? Like, is anything happening until the very, like, end, the climax of the film? Then suddenly everything erupts, and it's like it becomes a different movie. Eddie, you mentioned, and I know that I'm skipping ahead. We'll go back and sort of touch on some things. But, Eddie, you mentioned after the movie concluded that in many ways this was more intense and darker than a Resident Evil film.
True. It was the way this film's tone carried throughout from beginning to end. It was very somber, like it was a long funeral procession from beginning to end. Even with all the action sequences and everything, it seemed like it was just really down. Like there was no hope. I got more hope out of watching a Resident Evil film, is what I had mentioned to you, or any other zombie apocalyptic type film. I'll probably get more joy and hope out of those films than watching this one again, because it just seemed like, man, nothing is like ever gonna go well for the future, and I have to look forward to turning into a crank. Take that into your dictionary.
Oh boy.
Oh no.
For those of you who haven't really followed the films, the cranks are the zombie people, essentially.
Not the Tim Allen and Jamie Lee Curtis movie.
Yeah, no.
No, we were not having Christmas with these cranks.
But
truth. Yeah, I was actually stunned by the time you get to the climax of the film, and I mean, just thing after thing after thing after thing goes wrong, and it's an escalating wrong. Like, by the end, by that sequence, the rest of the film kind of meandered a little bit, I thought. Like, it starts with an action sequence, you know, people running on a train trying to free their friends and whatever. So it starts with action. The action overall, I thought the action sequences, the stunt choreography was actually pretty good in the film. It didn't look like people were throwing fake punches and falling for no reason like you sometimes get in movies that try to move so fast that they do it sloppy.
Yeah.
This didn't feel like the action sequences, the fisticuffs and like the stunt work. It didn't seem rushed and sloppy. It
Did
seemed
you say
really
fisticuffs?
Deliberate. Fisticuffs.
Fisticuffs.
You know. Like, pow, like bang, English whammo, fisticuffs. Slammy. You know, like, you know, the 1960s Batman.
Adam West over here.
Yeah. So, I thought that the stunt choreography actually was well done in almost every scene that you had stunt choreography. But by the time you get to the... But then you have all these, like, long stretches of no action where they're just talking and half the words are made up. So you're like, I don't really care anyway. Can we just move along? But then you get to the end. And by the climax, it honestly, to me, felt like... Like when you have a nightmare,
yeah,
right? And you're trying to escape a bad situation and you get into a worse situation and you try to escape that and you get into a worse situation and suddenly the entire building is on fire falling down around you. And like that's literally what's happening in this film. And I was like, I was sitting there thinking, man, they really took this to a dark place. I mean, you know that it's not a happy story. I mean, these kids are basically enslaved and killed off so that in their blood there might be a cure to a disease that at first they don't even know exists. They're dropped into the place in the first movie with amnesia. They don't know who they are, where they came from, where they've landed, none of it. So, Spencer, you have a very like perplexed look on your face.
Because I just realized I don't understand why they have amnesia in the first film.
That's a great question. I don't know why either.
Zero difference if they remember everything or not because they're still stuck in a maze.
Well, because so in the first film / book, they give them amnesia so that they can forget about where they came from because they ultimately got kids from all, you know,
walks
of life, ultimately, you know, from the rich to the poor. And because of the fact that their bodies were immune to the disease that was ravaging the outside world. So it didn't matter if they were poor or rich. If their children had this unique ability, they would get their mind wiped. And then that's why in this film, she was saying like, oh, you're still thinking about so-and-so. Well, if you want, we can do a procedure and we can remove that.
Yeah, I get that. I don't understand because it doesn't really make much of a difference overall.
Spence...
Like,
there is. I'm on your wavelength. There's a lot about the basic underlying logic of the foundational plot that is like just a giant like what?
Constantly,
why?
People are like, making weird choices.
The basic logic of this story is there's a zombie plague. Some people are immune, so we are going to try to make a serum from their blood that cures us. And the way that we're going to make sure that we get the best blood is by putting them through death-defying trials in unique environments, not telling them why they're there, letting some of them die, and then, like, just taking their blood. And it's sort of like that basic logic literally doesn't make any sense.
That didn't make sense to you guys? I just thought it was understood.
It made no sense. Plus, what was very confusing to me is that one of the kids from the Glade that's supposed to be immune dies from the infection. Like, that just kind of implies that Wicked themselves were like, well, we don't really know if these people are immune, so let's just throw them all in and see what happens.
Like, what's that, Marcy? Your kid's being a brat? Well, toss them in.
Well, it's like, it's not surprising they made zero progress when you have that kind of, like... If you're looking for a specific enzyme from people, why are you putting people who do not have this enzyme inside a maze? Why?
But why are you putting anybody in a maze to begin with?
Why are you putting people... Why is there a maze, period? Why is there a huge
walled like the
maze?
It's like the worst form of timeout.
Seriously.
Ever.
It's like, okay, like, well, we were going to make this really cool football game league that, you know, required people to actually go out of a maze, but it didn't work out because players kept dying.
Or, like, do actual, like, sports conditioning or something with them.
Or just tell them, hey, we think you might have a cure for this really terrible virus. You see this monster over here? We think you might be able to cure them if we just scare you a little bit. Do you think you'd be willing to help us? That would probably go a lot better than this nonsense maze garbage.
It is a lot of nonsense. You're right. It's a lot of nonsense.
A lot of nonsense and wasted resources. Where are you getting all this concrete from? It's the end of the world.
Where are you getting all this concrete from?
How are you building these structures? I don't get it.
No, go ahead. Just let it out.
That's
Spencer. Go ahead.
That's
just
good.
And then, like, okay. So in the first movie, you have them, they're getting out of the maze. And some of these kids have been stuck here for 3 years. The galley kid, the big bully, he's like, well, I'm going to stay in the maze because this is where we're safe, which, whatever. So they're in, like, the facility's exit. And, like, all the kids turn around and then Galley's there. And he had been, like, stung by the poison from the flare virus, which is what it's called. I don't know if we've mentioned that by name.
We
so
haven't,
far.
But that is what it's called.
Yeah.
The flare turns you into
a zombie.
A crank.
A crank.
Which is a zombie.
But you came from the glade, and you were a greenie when you first got to the glade, so you could go through the maze and avoid the flare and end up in the scorch to go to the city to fight Wicked.
I swear he's speaking in tongues.
Thank you. This is... I know it's my soapbox. I'm harping on it a lot. Like, the vocab itself is very off-putting to me.
It was like running water. It just kept coming out from the chat. That's what happens when you sit in a 2.5 hour movie. Oh,
and that's like 20% of the special words in this series.
There's way too many.
It's incredible how much this film just expects the audience to take for granted. Like, okay, yeah, this is the way this is. Okay. And this is how we do that. Okay. Like, for instance, you were saying the galley character.
Yeah, I was saying he had made his way through the maze by himself, even though he said he wasn't going to. And that means he would have had to take out one of these monsters by himself and then travel to where they were. And that, like, that was so improbable and so nonsensical. I was like, what is happening?
Especially since a whole group of them had to work together to get out of that.
Yeah, there's no way this one kid was getting out by himself. Like, the movie had made it kind of like, yeah, you need a group to go with you.
How'd you make it, Galley? I got top billing.
And so, like...
Yo, yeah, because he's back in this film.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he gets stabbed with a spear in the first film.
Yeah.
And you assume he's dying, or he's going to die in that film. And then we're looking at the credits on IMDb. I'm like, oh, look who it is. It's William Poulter. Maybe he's a ghost. Nope. Sure enough.
That would have been better if he was a ghost.
That would have been much better. But nope, we saw his crazy eyebrows in a lot of those scenes.
Crazy eyebrows.
Oh, that man. Every time I look at him, he looks like a clown. Like, I don't mean like in the way like he looks ridiculous. His face literally looks like a clown to me. Does anybody else?
I see it when you say you actually turned at one point in the film and said that in the middle of a fairly serious scene. He looks like a clown.
Because the conversation.
I can see it when you bring it up. I see it.
The conversation we had was far more interesting than what I was seeing on the screen, just so you know. So,
right.
But yeah, you know, with these types of films, there's a lot that you're just supposed to. Okay, that's fact. And okay, that's how that works. And that's how that works, like the improbability that there are people that will find you in that exact moment, in that exact place. Sometimes it's workable, sometimes, you know, but then in every instance, like, who the heck is going to drop a crane hook from God knows how high to the exact spot right next to the woman who needs it so she can hook up a bus? That makes no sense. And I know this is a ridiculous movie, but those just improbable things, just like, I feel my blood pressure going up.
Yeah, there's a lot of improbability, especially as you get toward the tail end of the film. I mean, at its core, this movie, the movie, I don't know about the book, the movie is a story about one of their good friends is in custody, mm-hmm. And being transported in the beginning on a train, and they are trying to locate the right train car to liberate him.
Oh my gosh, I got so irritated when I was watching this. Because, like, he's just pounding on the side, and then, all these kids inside start pounding back. It's like, oh, this is the one.
This is the one.
There were other cars, dude. Check them. Oh, gosh. I was so...
That was wonderful. That
I lost
so
my
crazy.
Mind in the first 5 minutes of this movie. I couldn't handle it.
Also, the paramilitary group that works with Wicked, I mean, they are like the new stormtroopers. They either like line up a shot and don't take it, or they wildly miss their shots repeatedly, because there are a number of, like, just physics. There are a number of angles that they actually had. Mm-hmm. The main characters repeatedly in their sights and didn't hit them in the midst of these big action sequences. So basically, they choose the wrong train car. They don't know until later that they've selected the wrong one. And so then they still need to try to save their friend, which is what then compels them to make some alliances and go all the way into, like, the main fortress, the last city apparently on Earth.
Which,
that,
by the
Wicked
way,
controls.
Yeah,
where there are, you know, walls around the city, and they've got to find a way in, and all of this stuff. But it's all to save one guy. Mm-hmm. They just want to save their one friend, and all these other people like get on board with them, and they're like, "Oh yeah, and while you're saving your friend, we can take down the man." Like, and there's just a lot again about the basic architecture and logic of the story that doesn't really make any sense.
Well, and consistent logic as well, because you have at the very beginning, after the botched rescue happens, looking for that one person, you have this conversation between Thomas, which is the main kid character, and an adult named Vince. And he's like, "You're not understanding. We have all these people here. We can't risk them for one person. We can't do it. We're about to, you know, all this is snap." And then it's like, okay, so then the main character goes, he's like, "Well, I'm going to do it myself." And he has two people come with him. By the end of the film, there's more people helping Thomas try to escape than there probably was still at the safe haven, wherever they were at in the beginning of the film. Like, there's all these people, not to mention all these other people that they've picked up in their hover plane. And it's like the consistency in terms of their logic was like, okay, so we're bending rules because it's Thomas? Or
yes, the movie does that constantly.
Yeah.
And another thing, and I asked Chad this, and I'll ask you, Spence, because okay, I don't know if you caught it as well. Did you catch the name of the militia group that William Poulter was with?
No, I did not.
Ah, see? In the book, they're called the Right Arm.
Wait, that's the Right Arm?
That's the Right Arm.
The Right Arm already showed up.
Did they?
Yeah, Vince is the Right Arm in this movie series.
Oh, well, there you go. Is he the leader of the Right Arm?
He's like the military leader. Well, he's all that's left of the Right Arm, so yes.
They're supposed to be the Right Arm.
Oh.
Well, there's a lot of conversation that's happened when the second movie debuted, because the second movie diverged significantly from the second book.
Yes.
And so now with the third movie, and I do think a good friend of ours did mention that in the second movie they introduced a group that actually is in the third book, but the way that they changed some of how the second movie worked, they prematurely introduced a group or a person or both. So there's been some alchemy, if you will, some story alchemy, where they're mixing materials to try to make the best whole, like, that they think is going to work on film.
Yeah, but the Right Arm was like decimated in like movie two.
Really? Because yes. in the second book, the Right Arm is non-existent.
Oh.
But the Right Arm is introduced in the third book, which is why William Poulter, that's how he's able to come back, and that's whom he works with at the time.
Oh.
So that's where he's been for the last week.
See, this is what happened
last week.
That
would actually make way more sense.
This is what happens when you tease these things out and recombine them, and then you end up with something different than what you started with.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet they thought that was the Right Arm. Oh, that makes so much more sense.
Light bulb, light bulb, light bulb, light bulb.
Just bing, 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 bing. Because I had never heard that term before. And so I was wondering, why are these kids just going with this military group without asking any questions during the second movie? But if they thought they were the Right Arm, that makes way more sense.
But it never says it in the third film. And they never establish it. They just... they're like some militia group that's there in that city or on the outskirts of the city. They never give a name. They never give, you know, where they hail from or who they, you know, are led by. And yeah, that got a little frustrating because I'm like, I think this is the right arm. I think this is them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They never really mention it. And that's really, I think that's one of the primary trouble spots. I mean, aside from basic logic of the story. For me, I haven't read the books. I've seen the first movie, hadn't seen the second one, full disclosure. But watching this movie, I was far more interested in some of the supplemental characters than in the main, like, kid characters. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but they don't explain them. Like, Walton Goggins is in this film. I don't think he was in the second film. I think he's new to this film.
Spence, he's was like, he in the second film?
He has this zombie infection thing. He has lost his nose off the front of his face. He takes what looks like an oxygen bar, like, hit of some kind of compressed air to keep himself from going full zombie mode. And he's the leader of this militia. That is just outside of the city. I found, like, the implication of that character to be far more interesting than any of the other characters that we were seeing, but you never learn where he came from, how he halted the progression of this, the flare.
Oh, that was from, like, the blue drip bag that he had on? That's what was preventing progress.
Oh, see, and this is the thing, like, I could very well have just not been paying very close attention, but, like, I would find a character like him because of the anachronism, like, the like, wait, you shouldn't be okay. Like, you shouldn't exist, like, half-transformed, but still, like, forming full sentences and leading people, like, you should be in quarantine or something, but he's not.
Yeah.
But you hardly spend any time with him.
Right.
True. And there's not much of a progression into his story in this film. And you're right. It's really trippy because of the fact that he looks hideous. But you're wondering, how is he, like, standing up? How is he moving? How is he even able to speak? You got people that are actually suffering from, you know, lighter progressions of the crank or whatnot, of the flare. And they're, like, totally incapacitated. But this guy looks like half of his face was stuck in a waffle iron, and he's over here giving monologues to groups of people. So, I mean, that's a really interesting point, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because I think the biggest issue with this film is really focusing on the most interesting parts of this film, or this story, because as great as it is to follow the kid, that's all well and dandy, but that's kind of what's expected. You know, it seemed like Patricia Clarkson's character seemed to have a lot more dynamic to her than was led on. I would have liked to know a little bit more of that struggle, or even figuring out what the heck is going on with what's his name, Littlefinger.
Okay, here's the thing.
I don't know his name.
Both of them. Aiden something or other is the actor's name. But yeah, from Game of Thrones, he plays Littlefinger. But those two characters, Patricia Clarkson's character and Aiden What's-His-Face's character.
Littlefinger.
His name's Jansen, by the way.
Jansen, thank you. I would have deleted them. They were totally uninteresting to me. They were cardboard cutout characters that, like, just, number one, the doctor lady, Patricia Clarkson, she basically stood there like a board. Like, she looked bored, and she looked like a board. Or like carved from stone. She didn't say anything intelligent ever. Like, she was supposed to be the lead researcher of this facility.
Mm-hmm.
She was neither wholly bad or wholly good. She was kind of just neutral in the middle. Her facial expression never changed. She didn't do anything interesting. And ultimately, she doesn't amount to much. And then you've got Littlefinger, who's just like scheming and snarling all the time, but also not, he doesn't have much dimension to him.
No.
And he doesn't really do that much. And also a terrible shot, by the way. And also decides to not pull the trigger when he should several times because it serves the plot and not his character's focus, which I get really frustrated with when they're like, oh, we're going to have him, like, corner them and then, like, not even deliver a monologue, but just, like, hold them at gunpoint until we decide that we want him to shoot them. Like, a character like that is going to just take the shot.
Yeah.
He's just
gonna,
and he's not going to corner them. He's going to take the shot from down the hall. Because in other scenes, he is taking shots and missing from down the hall. So it's like there's no consistency with that character. He's a plot device. He's not a character. So I would have deleted both of them. They annoyed me to no end in this movie.
And this has been an ongoing problem in the series, is because both of them had the same problems in the last movie. Because he's terrible at his job as is. Because
what is his job? Is he head of security?
Yeah,
or
he's
what?
Head of security.
And yeah, I never would have guessed that ever. Lame.
Because so many people escape his watch. You have the kids in the basement escaped. You have Thomas and his group escaped from his lab in the last movie.
Yes.
You are fired because you are incompetent.
Love it.
Yeah, and for me...
The mic, man.
Right?
Escaped.
I don't even know if we should continue this conversation or even
you
continue this review.
You are fired.
All right, are you good?
I'm good. I'm real good.
You quenching the flames over there? All right. Well, and another thing with his character, too, I mean, so we've talked about it in terms of inconsistent accents that sometimes pull you out of the film, and he is a class A example of what that is. I couldn't tell if he was trying to be English at sometimes or if he was trying to... I didn't realize that he was trying to do an American accent until, like, the end of the film when he's, you know, getting his comeuppance.
Yeah, you really have to listen, essentially, to see if he does the R sound the way an American accent would actually make the R instead of the British accent in some words, to even get a bead on, like, okay, what accent is he trying to have?
Yeah.
Because he did go back and forth. But who cares? Like, I didn't want to pay attention to him, and I didn't want to pay attention to the doctor lady. The Teresa girl, I would have deleted her too, because everybody made a big deal about her being a traitor and her allegiance and whatever, but she kind of just sits there and plays the middle of the road as well. It was a very frustrating film in terms of the characterization of the characters.
Here's a question.
Uh-oh.
What is Teresa's job at Wicked?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Apparently, she's a brilliant researcher slash presenter. I don't know.
Which, like, based on the first movie, I would not have said that at all. She was just working on a computer panel, like, slightly close to Thomas, because they both worked in, like, a lab.
Right.
But they didn't do any of that stuff before, so this kind of came out of nowhere for me.
And it makes you wonder, too, like, okay, so if she's such a brilliant whatever she does, why was she put in the maze in the first place?
Hey, that's a great question. Why was she in this maze?
Why were any of them in any maze ever? Why did they make mazes?
A maze. Come on. Out.
All right, let's kind of jump forward to the end of the film. How did we feel about how this film wrapped everything up?
Can I talk about Teresa again?
Please, yes. Please don't stop.
This girl.
I'm
okay.
Losing it here.
So she's on the PA. She's like, Thomas, you have to come back. I know you don't trust me, but like, I think you have to cure.
She does like a citywide broadcast.
Okay.
Bay. Bay. Come home, Bay.
And so, like an idiot, he goes back. But that's not even the part that bothers me. The part that bothered me is when they're on the roof. And they're trying to escape. They've got this helipad, this helicopter that's kind of, sort of, not, like, trying to rescue them. And so she, like, pushes him off of the building onto the helicopter and then just stands there as the building collapses. And I was like, get on the plane. You can do it. You have enough time. Because... like, she's, like, the last Wicked researcher who understands how to make a cure. What are your plans going to be to distribute a cure of some sort if you don't have someone who knows how to take it out of Thomas?
Here's, you want me to upset you even more?
Oh, no.
So, according to the book, as I said, they all get put back into a maze at the end of the book, including Teresa.
Why?
I don't know.
What?
So, everybody's in the maze, but they're all... on their way to leaving the maze. They found a way to get out of the maze. As they're making their way, the right arm, have found all the locations of where all the mazes are and are sending missiles and everything to destroy every maze. While they're destroying that maze that they're in, there is a wall that is falling, and Teresa sees that the wall is going to fall on Thomas, and she pushes him out of the way and gets squished.
Wait, hold on. So the Right Arm is a malicious group in the books?
Yeah, they're very terroristic.
Okay.
Which is why the group in this film
would fit the Right Arm.
Would be the Right Arm.
Oh, no. In the movie, analog. The Right Arm is a good group.
Here's another thing. Was I the only one? So at the end of this film, they all make it to this, like beachside property somewhere.
Yeah, it's like the central coast of California is what it looked like to me.
And they've established homes or whatever, and they've created, you know, little cottages and whatnot. Am I the only one that got like Lost vibes? Like, oh my god, they all died in the in the craft, and they're all in heaven right now.
I didn't.
They all died. They all went to heaven, and this is their reward for their life.
That's interesting. No, well, because in the earlier part of the film, what's his face, the leader of the good people, he was talking about how they were almost finished retrofitting the ship, and they were going to take to the ocean to get away from all the nonsense of the mazes and the whatever. So they have now the ship has been retrofitted and is anchored off the coast of this beach where they've set up a nice little like a open air commune kind of thing going on. I don't know. I'm an optimist. So seeing a bit of a happy ending after all the nonsense that was the climax of this movie, where like literally you go from the fortified ultimate city in the span of 15 to 20 minutes of screen time becomes like the underworld. All the buildings are basically destroyed, falling down. There's explosions in every street and all of this just craziness, all sorts of craziness. It's like a nightmare. It's like watching a nightmare play out. So it was nice to have like this more idyllic beachfront property, kind of like kumbaya moment. They're all like carving names into the stone to commemorate the people that they've lost, including Teresa. Yeah, but it was very like, at least there was a bit of a sigh of relief, I guess, at the end of all of the adrenaline.
It was almost over. The movie was almost over.
But I did not get Lost vibes out of it, but it's interesting that you did.
I was watching it. It wasn't until he was like, and to those that aren't here, and we write their names, and I'm like, oh, okay, they're not dead. Okay. Well, because there's a scene when they've got what's-his-name, Thomas, into the craft when you were talking about with the push and him. And then they switch to another scene, and there's one of those crafts, and it's trying to fly somewhere, and then it blows up. And I'm like, oh, they got blown up. And then that...
What?
And then it transitioned. Yeah, there was...
I saw that. I was like, they didn't just do that.
They got blown up.
I thought that for a quick second. I was like, no, they'd make more of a big deal.
And then he wakes up over here in this beachside paradise, and I'm like, oh, he's in heaven.
Oh, he could be dead.
Exactly. As I'm like, oh, I swear, I may shed a tear if Newt comes out. He's like, hey, Tommy, how's it going? As I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah, Newt is the Samwise Gamgee of this story.
Truth. Yeah.
And he was basically the only thing that fully worked for me about about the way that the characters interacted.
I liked Giancarlo Esposito's character for some reason. He just seemed random as
hermano.
Heck.
Hermano, hey, you know, we couldn't do that, hermano.
So that was great. But altogether, aside from the massive amounts of hits or misses with you guys, let's go ahead and talk whether or not this film passes or fails and how many monocles. And we shall start with I'll go ahead and jump start that way you guys can get your
go for it
point ones on me. The film as a whole passes because of the fact that I don't have to worry about any more.
That's a really interesting personal reason.
It's completely done. The series is kaput. They're not thinking about doing any more of these, and I don't know how much more I can express of how much I am so done with the young adult book series genre. I just we need more people like Pierce Brown and just Suzanne Collins to really just bring up the next level yeah. of what storytelling is going to be about. So, but in terms of Monocles, I would give it a 1.5. One for the stunts and the yep. visual editing and the different aspects of that, and the 0.5 for Newt.
That's very nice, very cute, sentimental.
What about you, Chad?
It fails for me because it was mostly annoying. I was trying to give it a fair shake. I really was, because I didn't see the second film, so I needed to give it the benefit of the doubt. Like, I could have missed some important stuff. Turns out it I don't know that it was all that important to what this movie does, because this movie kind of just doesn't really have a consistent internal logical structure of its own, which always gets me. We've talked about it before on other episodes with other movies. So it fails for me, although to your point, which was to my point earlier, the stunt choreography was pretty impressive most of the time for me. Yeah, Newt was a high point. I would give it one monocle.
Spence?
Oh, I might give it like 1.25, because, you know, to have your main star like get seriously injured in an on-set accident
and postpone
the entire production for a year and then come back and come up with something that I don't think it would have been any more cohesive if they had filmed it all at once. Yeah. I think it was just a bit of a hot mess no matter how you slice it. So to come with something that looks cohesive for what it is, I'll give him a quarter of a monocle just for, like, you know, giving it some good effort, some elbow grease.
And just real quick to that point as well, and to not also be like jaded and be like, well, you know what, that I'm not doing that stuff anymore. I'm just, he actually went back to the picture. He finished it. He gave it a great effort. And yeah, you're right. That's something commendable. Spence?
This movie fails for me.
I'm shocked.
I feel like there's just so much underneath that sentence right there.
You have to have logical consistency in your movie, and your characters should ask questions when events happen. Like when someone shows up, who are you? What are you doing here? Oh, you want to help me? Why? Like, I don't feel like these are really difficult questions to ask. But overall score, give it a 2, because there were quite a few things I did like. I really did like Newt. Brenda had some really great screams throughout this movie when she was driving the bus. It just made me giggle during the movie. She okay. like, ran to two cars like, ah! And I'm like, ha-ha. It was like, that made my day for some reason.
That's great.
But yeah.
The little things, Spence.
Little things. You got to find them.
They're so now there. Now are you excited for Alita, Battle Angel? Because it's that actress.
Yeah, I noticed that, but the eyes still bother me.
Yeah, the eyes are really bothersome.
I'm probably going to want
to. I'm sorry, did you give how many monocles?
He did. He
you
gave
said
two.
Two. Okay, two.
I was the low score this time, which never happens.
Wow. Not by much, though, by a quarter.
So yeah, that's true.
So
yeah.
It's not two. Well, that about wraps up another episode of the Philosophers. I was about to say, y'all Shanks need to come and listen.
I knew you were going
to bring
Shanks
back into this. Don't be a greenie. Listen
to
us on our... let us know what you thought about the film, and if you liked it or disliked it, drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we go, we're going to let you know of an upcoming movie release this weekend, Winchester, which, uniquely enough, we have some type of semblance to it because of the fact that the Winchester House actually is... in Northern California.
Northern California.
And we are in Northern California, so that'd be interesting. I wonder if they'd have an issue with us doing a review of that in the Winchester House.
You should look into it.
Well, like I said, this was a fun talk. This was a fun conversation. I always enjoy hearing Spencer freak out about films and whatnot, and I'm pretty sure I could say the same thing for you all that is listening right now. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.